This is Jean Meth and Muriel Gutman for the Council of National Jewish Women. We are interviewing Arthur Jaffe. We are now on side three.
Arthur, when we finished our interview last week, you were telling us about going into the Army. Was there anything significant in your experiences in the Army that you would like to tell us about? Did you go in, you went in as an officer?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And?
I was in for 4 years.
In this country?
No, I was in this country about two, and in Europe about two. Mm-hmm. I originally was an infantry officer and a platoon commander of a rifle company.
Yeah.
I know. I don't know if I told you that when you enter the Army, you, as an officer at that time, you had to weigh 125.
Yeah. You said you had to gain
weight.
What was
unusual was that a Jewish infantry officer wasn't too common. And in a rifle company, there were practically no Jews. There was practically everything else but a Jew. And I have no way of knowing what my men thought about me.
I was going to ask you, was there any reaction? Did they know you were Jewish?
Oh, yeah. They knew I was Jewish for a number of reasons. First of all, in the Army, I continued to be active in Jewish activities.
In which way?
Leading services, wherever I was. Asking for time off when it was Jewish holidays, this type of thing, where it was obvious that I was a Jewish Jewish officer. And of course, your name tag said what you are. You know, when you went in the Army, you had to say whether you were Jewish or whatever, and along with your blood type and the rest of the basic information. So the dog tag I wore said I was Jewish. So that was obvious.
Were you harassed in any way?
Not particularly. A couple times, yes. Harassed in this fashion, officers would get together. Well, I went to a training camp for one point, what they call a refresher course for officers at Fort Benning, Georgia. And that's infantry training. That's rugged kind of training, as you can imagine. And when we would get together in the evening after the training was over, and we'd sit around in your bunks and go out for a drink or whatever it might be, there were officers who said we're in this war only because of you Jews. It's your war. Yes. I did run into that. We'd get into pretty heated arguments, you know, and I would give the reasons why we're in the wars quite different. And but from that point of view, yes, there was a certain kind of harassment. But there was no harassment from my higher officers at all. They just wanted me to do my job. And I suppose the men said things behind my back, but I would have no way of knowing what it is that they would say. It was kind of uncommon for them to find a Jewish. I was kind of unique just to find a Jewish officer in the infantry. You would see them in the Air Corps, and you'd see them in the Medical Corps, the judge advocates, and some of those kinds of places, but not too often in the infantry.
Did you go overseas from there, before Benning?
No. I traveled around the United States for a while. I was in Camp Meade and Camp Carlisle and Croft and Knox and Blanding and Benning and Gordon. I kind of lost track of all the various places that I went. I was eventually assigned to the 26th Infantry Division, which was the Massachusetts National Guard Division, which had been activated, of course. And my first major post was in Charleston, South Carolina. And that was very interesting to me. It's the oldest Jewish community in the United States. And I immediately gravitated towards the synagogue and the temple. Well, what would happen really was there was a USO. Do you remember the USO?
Mm-hmm.
And the USO would find out that you were Jewish, and then the Jewish people, the community, would come and say, "Would you come home and have dinner with us?" And so I started to meet some of the members of the Jewish community. And the first people who took care of me was a family by the name of Arthur Victorious Williams. And they were leading lights of the Jewish community of the old temple in Charleston. And the name Arthur Victorious Williams was an indentured name. His grandfather came to this country from England, was indentured to a man called Arthur Victorious Williams. So that was where he got the name. And Arthur Victorious Williams, the second or third or whatever he is living today, is my age, roughly my age, is a physician, a very famous physician in Charleston, who was one of the world's leading authorities on kidney transplants. And he was not in the Army at the time, but he became a friend of mine, roughly my age. So I got, and then I was asked to speak, and I conducted some services and met the congregation. We met the Jewish community. And it kind of was beshared in a way, because eventually I, as you know, I married a Southern girl.
I was going to ask you if that's where you met your wife.
No. But the old Southern Jewish community, and as you remember, this was before the Second, during the Second World War, before the big migration around the country. So that the Jews who were living in such places as Savannah and Charleston, Atlanta, were Jews who had been there a long time, like Arthur Victorious Williams, who came there before the Civil War, during the Civil War, right after the Civil War. And so as a result, the Southern Jewish community, like in North Carolina, South Carolina, in Georgia, many of them were related to one another, or came to their families came together and settled there. And so they were like one great, huge mishpacha, one great family. So that when my engagement to Lois was announced in the Southern Israelite, which was the paper for the entire South Jewry, I got many congratulations from people who remembered me from the Second World War in Charleston, South Carolina.
Wasn't it Harry Golden's
paper?
Yes.
Did you meet Lois in this period of time?
No, I met Lois. You want to hear that story now?
Well, I don't know. Do you want to tell it, want to go overseas and then
come back?
Back,
yeah, because it came back. It was
when you came back.
It was long after I came back.
It
was after I came back from Israel, actually.
Wasn't that the paper edited by Harry Golden?
Harry Golden, yes. There was, and so, you know, that was. So I didn't know that I was going to marry a Southern girl many years later that would be friends of the people that I became friendly with in Charleston, South Carolina. But we were patrolling the coast of South Carolina at that time, protecting the coast, living in the islands off of Charleston and South and North Carolina. We were living in if you might remember that during the Second World War, as a matter of fact, we found and apprehended German soldiers who were infiltrated through submarines and dumped off the coast of South Eastern United States. They were sent to spy and to do things here and sabotage. And one of our jobs was to try to spot these people, and in fact we did apprehend some people, the Germans who were trying to be infiltrated. So we did that for a while, and then I was went to Camp Benning, Fort Benning, just for a refresher, company was moved from different camps for different phases of our training. And then we were on maneuvers in Kentucky or Tennessee, probably Tennessee. And I was in the field. We'd been in the field for a number of weeks, living in the field. And I got a call one night, very late at night, like about 11 o'clock at night. One of those dealing phones that you see in the movies, you know, I want to speak to Lieutenant Jaffe. Lieutenant Jaffe here said, how would you like to be transferred to military intelligence? Well, it was so miserable out there, I thought anything was going to be great. I said, that'd be wonderful. I said, how's that coming about? They said that we've had a request for you. Me? Yes, for you. I said, oh, that's terrific. Where am I supposed to go? They said, we think almost immediately. Where am I going? Well, you're going to Maryland, Camp Ritchie, Maryland. So there was two or three days later, something like that, I got orders. And I packed up and went off to Camp Ritchie, Maryland, where I was transferred to military intelligence. And the reason I got into military intelligence is a fluke. What they did when you went into the Army, they did an intake interview. What did you do? What was your education? Where'd you come from? All that sort of thing. And in the early days of computerization, what they did was they had a card called a Form 20. Form 20 was your information card, your name, where you were born, your family, and all your history. And around the edge of that, they had little holes, dozens of holes, the whole way around the card. And then what they would do would be punch out the hole like you speak French. So then when they wanted to know all the people in the Army who spoke French, they would put the card to the machine and they'd run a line through it, and anything that fell out on that, those are all the French-speaking people, and so on. It happened while I was in college that I had taken classical Greek, and I had taken some Latin, continued with Latin, and I had taken some French, and I had taken some German. And so I had all these languages, and knowledge of all of these languages on my Form 20, and they were looking for language specialists. So, not only you couldn't do anything with classical Greek, I mean, that wasn't the issue. That wasn't refined. Computerization was not that refined. All it said was he speaks more than one language, you see. And my French was really rudimentary, and my German was really bad. At any rate, they quickly found out that the classical Greek wasn't going to be any use at all, and there were people in the Army who spoke a great French and a great German. They didn't need me for that. In any event, they were forming these companies called psychological warfare companies. And I was put into one of those as an officer in second in command, a company titled the Second Mobile Radio Broadcasting Company. You have to recall that prior to the Second World War, less than, I think, maybe something like 13% of all high school graduates went to college.
Yeah.
And people like myself, anybody with an education was very special. I mean, with an advanced education, it was very, very special. And there weren't a lot of us like there are now, where maybe 50, 60, 70% of high school students go on to some kind of advanced education, if it's only community college. But then, it was just a few of us, really. And so I was the second in command of this particular company. We had 140 men in the company and 20 officers. It was a very high ratio of officers. Usually you don't have that many officers for that kind of number of men. Spoke 33 languages. It was a special company, and they had experimented with this kind of a company in North Africa, and it was kind of successful. What this company did, essentially, was as soldiers were captured, they were interrogated, not when they were taken back to the prisoner of war camps, but immediately. Because when you capture somebody and you question them immediately, that's when somebody is very vulnerable, before they are oriented, before they have the support of other prisoners of war around them, before there's the discipline imposed within the camp itself. But if you grab a soldier the moment he's captured and you interrogate him, he will tell you things that he may not tell you once he gets his wits about him again. And so these men were trained to do that in this particular company. And then we would take those pieces of information that we learned from the soldiers and take it back to specialists within the company who would write leaflets and who would or would do actual broadcasting through either radio or directly on loudspeakers to the troops right in the field. A variety of things that we would do to break their morale and to explain to them their situations, that we know this about you, and you're better off surrendering, and if you surrender, we will take care of you, and we will, you know, you won't be harmed, right, and so forth. Yeah, mm-hmm. Really. But this was done on the battlefield. This was done on the battlefield.
Which country?
Well, my company did this in France, Germany, Holland, Belgium.
You traveled?
Yep. We went with D-Day, and then went right through. So we have many famous men in our company, many famous people, and famous at that time, and, people who were attached to us. We worked with Wild Bill Donovan, that name was with OSS. We were attached with OSS troops and OWI, Office of War Information. We had Paley from CPS, the young man at that time, attached with us, and we had many movie writers. They were people who escaped from Germany, directors in France who escaped the Nazism, came to this country, and were in Hollywood, people who worked for the Disney studios, who were graphic artists. We had all these kinds of people in this company, and many Jews, as you would imagine, in that company. Most of them were European intellectuals, novelists.
You said that you were involved in this for approximately 2 years.
Yes.
Overseas.
I went into that company in 1943, late 1943. Middle 1943. We left for Europe in 1943, and I was with that company until I was discharged 44 and 45 for 2 years. Yep.
At which point you
December 1943.
At which point you came back to settle where?
I came back. Of course, I had a lot of interesting experiences in Europe, many of them related to being Jewish. And,
well, why don't you tell us?
Tell us.
Well, first of all, our company was attached to General Bradley's headquarters. And there was no Jewish chaplain attached to that particular area that we were located in. And so the Gentile chaplain asked me to serve as the kind of Jewish chaplain. So I used to have services. I conducted the Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur services in Verdun, France. And I bombed that synagogue. A roof on it, packed with troops, pouring rain on us. I have pictures of all that. But the army took, I didn't take. I mean, they had, you know, they were going around photographing everything. I found the Torahs along to that synagogue.
What do you mean you found
them? Well, what had happened was when France was invaded in June of 39. In this small town there was a synagogue, Verdun, France, and they knew that the Germans would go, people in the community knew that the Germans would, the Jews knew in the community that the Germans would come to the synagogues and desecrate the synagogues and take the Torahs and burn them or do something else with them. So apparently, one of the couple of the leaders were friends and non-Jewish friends of the Jewish community, took the Torahs and hid them in their homes. And I didn't know this, of course. Nobody knew this. Until one person in the community of Verdun, from where my company was stationed at the time, knew I was Jewish and knew that that I was active as a kind of a Jewish leader for this little area and conducted services and so on at the synagogue, and that was obvious. A kid came to me one day and said, local, he said, well, there's the Torahs, the scrolls, those are not a Jewish thing, said, they're here in this community. And he said, where? He said, well, he said, I will take you where. And he took me to a home. And there was a very tiny home, and there was knocked on the door, and the woman answered, and he explained who he was in French. She came down the steps. She was very old, maybe 80 years old. At that time, she seemed even older to me, you know, 80 down here is leadership practically. So. Anyway, she seemed very old. After all, I was only 23 or something like that at the time. And she talked to me for a while. She said, come with me. And I came up to her attic. And she had a pile of newspapers, and underneath the newspapers were two scrolls, two towers. The dates of the paper were the days of the invasion of the community. June 1939, or whatever the date was. She had hidden them, and she was Catholic. And, as a matter of fact, her sister was a nun. And she said, I said, weren't you scared? She said, yes, only once. She said, you know, the Germans, troops, the officers are billeted in private homes. And I had an officer, two officers staying with me in this home. She said, they looked around. She always was fearful that one day they would go up into the attic and uncover that, but they never did. They never did. And so we got the scroll from her. It was Christmas. This was about Christmas time, and I couldn't do much for her, but I was able to send her, which was very valuable at the time, a huge basket of food which they didn't have. You know.
This was the Christmas of what year? 40?
I would say it'd be 44. Christmas of 44.
They really took a chance doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They did. There were people who did take chances. One of them, you know, I suppose living in we talked about this earlier, living in a small community, you know what it is to be a Jew. You also know that there are people who are good people and who are your friends, true friends, forever.
Regardless.
So they may not be Jewish. So that there are good people and who stand the test of time.
Well, we found that out when they saved the children.
Yeah, there are. Sometimes you think there aren't, but you see the bad and the good in a small city. You know that there's really bad. You also know that there's good.
Did you come home from Verdun?
No. The war was not over in 44.
Oh, that's right.
I stayed in Europe until the war was over in May, which was May 45. I was released I was sent back to the United States. I accumulated points. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I had been in a long time. I was an officer. I had been in combat. You got points for being in battles and all that sort of thing. And so I qualified fairly early. And I was released, sent back to the United States in September. I got back to the United States in October because I was in charge of a ship coming back. It was a Liberty ship, and I was the highest ranking officer, the highest ranking officer in charge of the ship. So I was in charge of the ship bringing back 200-300 short soldiers. I guess that's what it took. I went over on the Elizabeth, which had 15,000 troops on it.
You mean the Queen Elizabeth?
People slept in the pool, and the pool was stacked high with bunks. The pool was emptied out, and we slept on the decks, and what you did was you alternated. Half the troops slept on the deck one night, and then the side, and then the next night the other half. So that they, it was shared, and the WACs had a separate quarters, which was hard to keep them separated. Remember the WACs?
Sure.
There were wax on board ship, and we had one guy from Pittsburgh there on board ship with us, Billy Kahn, a fighter. And he was giving an exhibition.
That was his war effort.
Mm-hmm. He and Joe Lewis was on too. And they sort of entertained the troops. JJ went out there. But I came back on a Liberty ship, which was like a really, a tin can. So I came back, I got back here in October of 1945, stayed here until January or February of 46 and went to Palestine.
Stayed here in Butler?
Yes. Well, not to stay in Butler the whole time. I was preparing going to Palestine. I went to New York to live in New York for about 6 weeks or so to take some Hebrew courses.
So it was in early 1946 you went to Israel. Why did you decide you wanted to do that?
Fluke, as most of, I think I've said that earlier, you know, accident is what leads our lives sometimes. When I was coming back, when I wrote to my father that I would be returning to the United States, the war was over, and I'd be coming back to the United States, I said to him that while I had graduated university prior to the Second World War, that I thought I'd like to go back to university for a year just to kind of get reoriented. I wrote to him, I'm okay, my mind's okay, my nerves are okay, but I thought, and I wasn't married, and I was still pretty young, and I thought it'd be a good idea to go back to university for a year. And so when I got back, he said, well, where do you want to go? And I said, well, you know, had good grades, Penn State, being an officer, I'm sure I can get into any place I want to get to. You know, I can go to Harvard or wherever I wanted to go. So he said, well, I've done a little research in anticipation of your return. And he had with him a sheet of paper with all the schools anywhere that qualified under the GI Bill of Rights. Remember the GI Bill of Rights?
Mm-hmm.
And in that was the Hebrew University. And I said, I think I'll go there. And just like that. I'd been very involved in Europe with the refugees. I didn't discuss that, but I had been. And I heard what was going on in Israel, and I thought, gee, it'd be kind of interesting to go to university there. And so I applied, and there was a small organization that had been set up in New York just by the Hebrew University to take care of such an idea.
In other words, they anticipated that this was going to happen.
They had a one-man office, one-person office, and he was fellow in charge of arranging for GIs to go, who were qualified to go to the Hebrew University, to go to the Hebrew University under GI Bill of Rights. Mm-hmm. And there were about eight of us. We were the first Americans to go to the Hebrew University after the Second World War. And that's how I went.
He was more wanting to
get
yourself reoriented rather than an idealistic.
Well, I've thought about it.
Thing.
I've thought about that. And I wondered why I went. I mean, as the years went over, why did I do that? It bothered me. And I have a different conclusion now. My conclusion is that get back into civilian life. And the reason that I wasn't ready to get back into civilian life was that I think the experiences we had been through were so intense that nobody would understand what had happened. And we just needed, I thought, we all needed some
time. Bridge.
We needed a bridge. And this would take me from one place to another without just plunging right back into the civilian life. I don't know that that's true, I guess.
Your father was probably pleased to have you go to school there.
Oh, he was delighted, you know. I think it's his fantasy.
All right, that's it.